Welcome to Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ehlich, and I'm your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And today is Sunday, September 7th, 2025. The following program was previously broadcast earlier this year. First, from Science News, the June 2025 issue. From the Department of Anthropology, Medieval Monks Wrapped Books in Pelts from Afar, by Alex Viveros. Science is helping researchers judge books by their covers and revealing surprising beneficiaries of medieval trading routes in the process. Dozens of rare fur-covered volumes from 12th and 13th century French monasteries are wrapped with seal skins, some of which may have come from as far away as Greenland, researchers reported in Royal Society Open Science Journal. The findings challenge the assumption that the book's makers used only locally sourced materials and suggest that they were part of an extensive trade network. The books hail from Clairvaux Abbey in northern France and related monasteries. Examining the tomes through a microscope, conservator Elodie Levic struggled to identify their furry outermost covers, so scientists compare proteins from the covers with known animal proteins, finding a match with seals. "I was like, that's not possible. There must be a mistake," says Levic of Panthéon Sorbonne University in Paris. Seals didn't frequent France's northern coast at the time, but DNA analyses confirmed the ID. The source may have been harbor seals near Scandinavia, Denmark, and Scotland, and harp seals near Greenland or Iceland. It's possible Norse hunters brought the skins to France, Levec says. What's more, she adds, the books were much furrier in their heyday, like a teddy bear. Medieval Monks Wrapped Books in Pelts from Afar in the Department of Anthropology. And a caption to the picture of one of the books says, "When monks in medieval France covered this book with seal skin, it was furrier and lighter in color." And this series of articles appears in the news section of the June 2025 issue of Science News. Next, from the June issue, the health checkup, Skeletons Belong on the Health To-Do List, by Amy Cunningham. "I confess," she writes, "if I think about skeletons, it's around Halloween. I especially enjoy the yard displays of larger-than-life skeletons engaging in mundane activities, like walking skeleton dogs. But our own skeletons are something we should be thinking about year-round, especially as we age. Heading into midlife and beyond, bones can lose their heft. A drop below a certain bone density leads to a diagnosis of osteoporosis and bones that are weak and fragile. Osteoporosis can happen to all adults, but it's more common in women. About 27% of U.S. women age 65 and older have this disorder, compared with close to 6% of men the same age, according to the latest available data from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Bones weakened by osteoporosis are more likely to fracture, which can be debilitating and even deadly. Hip fractures are especially devastating. Around 20% of people die within 1 year of fracturing a hip. Only 40 to 60% of survivors are likely to regain their pre-fracture mobility. In January of this year, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force reaffirmed its recommendation that women 65 and older should be screened for osteoporosis. That's done with a bone density test. A lot of emphasis on the postmenopausal 65-plus population is warranted because we know that fractures happen at a higher incidence, says Nicole Wright, an osteoporosis epidemiologist at Tulane University in New Orleans. But it doesn't necessarily mean that younger women should not be concerned about their bone health. Bone loss really gets going right around menopause. starting the year before the last menstrual period and for about 2 years after, bone density drops about 2% per year on average due to the decline in estrogen. Bone loss continues more slowly after that. However, there isn't a blanket screening recommendation for postmenopausal women age 50 to 64. Women at higher risk of developing osteoporosis might be screened. Smoking or a history of fracture are among the risk factors that could warrant screening. Women with conditions that can cause osteoporosis, such as rheumatoid arthritis, diabetes, and disease, or who take certain drugs that raise the risk, should already be closely watched. For younger postmenopausal women, it's challenging to predict future fracture risk. Osteoporosis risk prediction tools don't work well, scientists reported in JAMA Network Open Journal. JAMA is the Journal of the American Medical Association. Nor does the tool for fracture risk prediction, past work has found. Bone density tests help determine whether a person needs osteoporosis drugs, says Christine Ensrud, an epidemiologist at the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis. Yet there isn't good evidence on the benefits versus the harms of beginning treatment in younger postmenopausal women. So these younger women are in limbo, or can be, with bone loss underway, but perhaps no cause to screen early, and scant evidence on how to proceed. However, there are ways to minimize the rate of decline in bone density. It's not here comes menopause, and now we all have osteoporosis, Wright says. To preserve bone health, the go-tos are exercise and nutrition. Weight-bearing exercises like walking and running are key, Ensrud says. And remember, a lot of fractures are related to falls, so work on your balance. It's also important to get enough calcium and vitamin D and to avoid smoking and excess alcohol, she says. If a woman is taking hormone therapy to treat menopause symptoms like hot flashes, there's the added bonus that the estrogen boost prevents bone loss. Wright wants to see more appreciation for the skeleton. While there's been a greater awareness about other health issues that affect women, such as breast cancer and heart disease, it's not there yet for osteoporosis and fractures, she says. We need to be thinking about it because there are things we can do. That news from the health checkup, skeletons belong on the health to-do list. And turning to the March 2025 issue of Scientific American, in The Science of Health, we have another article about breaking bones. This one is entitled, Healing Broken Legs Faster. Putting weight on a fracture within weeks can help it mend, by Lydia Denworth. 20 years ago, my husband, Mark, broke his left ankle and was in a cast and on crutches for nearly 2 months. Last year, he broke the other ankle. But this time, after surgery, his doctor surprised us by instructing Mark to walk on it 2 weeks later. It turns out the standard advice to stay off a broken leg bone for at least 6 weeks is based less on scientific evidence and more on cultural caution. Physicians like to play it safe. But now studies show that complications are no more likely with early weight-bearing than with a long delay. Except in a few complex cases, walking around earlier helps broken bones heal, and it improves quality of life. For example, people can return to work and other activities faster. If you are fully immobilized, you come out of the cast with a sort of hairy, withered leg that takes forever to overcome, says orthopedic trauma surgeon Alex Trumpeter of St. George's University of London. The science tells us that the rate at which you lose muscle mass is far faster than the rate at which you gain it. You're slow to build bone, too. Consider astronauts. After 6 months in zero gravity at the International Space Station, they lose 10% of their bone density, and to ward off that loss, they do exercises in space that are equivalent to bearing weight. In the 19th century, German surgeon and anatomist Julius Wolff recognized that healthy bones adapt and change in response to the load placed on them. That is why everyone, but especially women, who are more susceptible than men to osteoporosis, which we also heard about in the previous article, should lift weights as they age. It increases bone density. When you fracture a bone anywhere in the body, physicians first worry about stability. How much will the bone fragments move if you put weight on them? If the answer is too much, surgery is usually indicated. First, a reduction to realign the pieces of bone, and then fixation to hold them in place with screws, plates, or rods. That procedure sets up a bone, which is living tissue, to heal naturally by making new bone and resorbing damaged cells. In the gap caused by a fracture, a healing tissue called callus forms first, which then turns into bone. The right amount of load or movement, here's where Wolff's discovery applies, is critical to this process. Too little results in no callus, and too much prevents the bone from knitting back together. It's all about the strain environment, says orthopedic surgeon Chris Bretherton of Queen Mary's Hospital in London. Surgical implants hold the alignment until that process is complete. It's a little bit of a race postoperatively between the bone healing and the fixation breaking, says orthopedic trauma surgeon Marilyn Heng of the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine. In that contest, she roots for the new bone. Once the body heals and forms bone across the fracture site, the hardware we put in becomes extraneous. The crux of our decisions for weight-bearing status is we want to win that race. And putting some load on the bones aids that goal. Although the process of bone healing is the same all over the body, bones in the lower limbs, such as hips, femurs, and ankles, bring extra complications because they affect the ability to walk. In patients with hip fractures, predominantly frail older people, that immobility can lead to dire consequences. Some patients do not have the dexterity and strength to manage partial weight bearing while using crutches, so they stay in bed. The lack of movement leads to serious problems such as blood clots and weakening of the lungs. One 2005 study found that 9% of hip fracture patients died within 30 days of breaking a hip, and that 30% died within the first year. But more recent studies of healing hips suggest that early weight-bearing decreases mortality rates, and doctors have altered their practices. The normal standard of care is now to fix it and let people walk, Trumpeter says. Breaks in long bones, like the femur in your thigh, can be relatively straightforward to repair with a rod. In a study that looked back at outcomes for a series of patients, Heng and her colleagues showed that those who walked early on femurs that had broken just above the knee had no higher rate of complications than those who stayed off the leg for 6 weeks. For ankles, the largest randomized controlled trial to date, 480 fracture cases across 23 centers in the UK, was published in 2024 in the journal Lancet. Half of the patients were instructed to walk after 2 weeks, and the other half were told to wait until after 6 weeks. Any complications, such as infections or broken plates, were equally common in both groups, so early walking didn't pose a greater risk. And the early weight-bearing group reported better function in the ankle at 6 weeks and at 4 months post-surgery. Surgeons just needed a push, says Bretherton, who led the study. He hopes this evidence gives them that confidence. As for my husband, he jumped at the chance to get moving sooner. In less than 2 months, the point at which he was just coming out of a cast last time, his scar was fully healed. He was walking normally, and with a few limitations, no running, no quick pivots, he was exercising again. It seems that he won this race. And the author of The Science of Health, Lydia Denworth, is an award-winning science journalist and contributing editor to Scientific American. She is author of the book Friendship, which was published in 2020 by W.W. Norton. And her column is in the March 2025 issue of Scientific American. Remember today's earlier article about babies and how they form memories. This next article talks about what happens when these children become adolescents. From the department The Science of Parenting, in the March 2025 issue of Scientific American, kids and smartphones. Use of smartphones has been blamed for all manner of societal ills. When should parents take the plunge and equip their kids with these devices? By Jacqueline Nezzi. Mental health concerns, exposure to pornography, addiction, loneliness, bullying. Adolescents' use of smartphones has been blamed for all manner of societal ills. For parents, the stakes feel impossibly high. Get your child a smartphone and you risk opening Pandora's box. Hold off and you risk ostracism from their smartphone-toting peers. When to take the plunge? What's the right age to get your child a smartphone? As a psychologist studying the role of digital technology in youth mental health and author of the parenting newsletter Techno Sapiens, I find this is one of the most common questions I get from parents. So here's the bad news. There is no one right age. But the good news? We can look to the research to make the right decision for your child and to help you feel more confident in your decision-making. Let's start with the basics. When your 12-year-old laments that every other kid in their grade has a smartphone, are they correct? According to nationally representative data from Common Sense Media, 42% of 10-year-olds report having their own smartphone. By age 12, that number increases from 42% to 71%, and by age 14, it's 91%. Of course, these numbers vary across different communities and settings, but these appear to be the averages. These numbers can tell us, broadly, the age at which other families are giving smartphones to their children, but they cannot tell us what age is best to do so. To really answer that question, we would need a specific type of research study that involved a large group of children. We would randomly assign them, some of them, to get smartphones at age 10, some at age 11, some at 12, and so on. We would then follow them over time to see how they develop emotionally, cognitively, and socially. Years later, we could compare, for example, the kids who got phones at 12 versus those who got phones at 17. There are a few reasons this study would not work in the real world. The first is the need for random assignment. Randomly assigning kids to get phones at different ages would allow us to determine whether any differences in outcomes were related to the phones. This is unlikely to happen. Few families would agree to have the smartphone decision determined by random chance. Of course, we can simply compare kids who got phones at age 12 with those who got phones at age 17. But without random assignment, it's very possible that the kids getting phones at age 12 were already different from those getting phones at age 17. Maybe they came from different family situations or economic backgrounds. Maybe they differed in their social or emotional maturity. These challenges may be why current research findings have been mixed, and some studies suggest that earlier smartphone acquisition negatively affects future well-being, whereas others find no impacts at all. Even if we were able to pull off this type of study, there would be another problem. Like all people, kids are very different from one another. 12-year-old children vary considerably in their needs, preferences, histories, emotional well-being, and social skills. Even if a study were to determine a single optimal age for kids to get smartphones, this would reflect an average. There would still be many kids for whom that optimal age was not the right one. So, how can you determine when to get your child a smartphone? Digital technology plays a key role in adolescents' social lives. 69% of teens say their smartphones make it easier for them to pursue hobbies and interests, and 80% say that social media, typically accessed via a smartphone, makes them feel more connected to what's going on in their friends' lives. When a young person asks for a smartphone, the motivation may be that everyone else has one, but the desire also might reflect a legitimate experience of missing out on social connections. If all your friends are making plans to hang out over text messaging and you're not in the group chat, you really are left out. There also may be safety or convenience reasons for wanting your child to have a phone. Maybe they are walking to and from school or you need to coordinate pickups from soccer practices or different households. At the same time, smartphones come with risks. We know that when phones are present, they can distract teens from academic work, interrupt in-person social interactions, and interfere with sleep. We also know that smartphones offer an in-your-pocket portal to everything on the internet, some of which we'd rather they not see. The best device for your child might be the simplest one that meets your needs. You may find that a dumber device, whether it's a basic flip phone, a kid-friendly smartphone, or a smartwatch, gets the job done just fine. Gradually introducing new tech gives you more opportunities to teach them about appropriate use. You might slowly progress from a shared family iPad to a basic mobile phone to a smartphone with strict parental controls to, eventually, a smartphone with access to social media and other apps. It's worth noting, too, that it can be a lot easier for parents to delay kids' smartphone acquisition when other families are following the same path. This is why organizations such as Wait Until 8th, which aim to mobilize communities to delay giving kids smartphones, have gained traction in recent years. Ready is a tricky word when it comes to smartphones, too. Is any child ever truly ready for a smartphone? Is any adult ready to navigate one of the most powerful technologies of our time without occasional mishaps and challenges? Determining whether your child is ready for a smartphone means recognizing their unique strengths and vulnerabilities, reflecting on their patterns of behavior, and preparing them for a major milestone that will require a lot of scaffolding on your part, not to mention some inevitable hiccups. Research consistently demonstrates that the ways in which children respond to technologies are highly individualized to both the child and the specifics of the technology they're using, a phenomenon called differential susceptibility to media effects. If your child is emotionally reactive or struggles to fit in socially, these issues may be amplified by a smartphone. If they're responsible, show good judgment, and generally follow the rules you've set, the smartphone may be a non-issue. Their prior experiences with technology, like tablets or other screens, can serve as a clue to how they'll respond. Whatever age you choose, you can set yourself up for success. Have conversations with your child about smartphones early and often. Introduce new tech gradually. Work together with them to set expectations and boundaries around use. Although there is no one right age for a smartphone, there can be a right time for your family. Trust yourself to know when that might be. Jacqueline Nezzi is a clinical psychologist and assistant professor at Brown University and author of the newsletter Techno Sapiens and co-founder of Tech Without Stress. She holds a PhD from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Her article, Kids and Smartphones, appears in the Science of Parenting in the March 2025 issue of Scientific American. In the March 2025 issue of Scientific American, Opinion and Analysis from Scientific American's Board of Editors. Facilitating immigration will fuel innovation. To maintain its competitive edge in science and technology, the U.S. needs to make it easier for foreign-born STEM workers to enter the country. In late December 2024, a social media storm erupted after entrepreneur Elon Musk blasted out support for the iconic H-1B visa. The temporary work visa has long served as a ticket to jobs in the U.S. high-tech industry for skilled foreign-born scientists and engineers. In response, President Trump's nativist backers pushed back immediately. Former Trump advisor Steve Bannon characterized Musk's position as a ploy by tech oligarchs to take jobs from Americans. Headlines proclaimed the outbreak of a MAGA civil war. Musk's remarks might seem self-serving, but he is right in highlighting the need for more engineering talent from overseas. Foreign-born tech workers are essential to fuel America's powerhouse economy, one that captures an outsized percentage of global gross domestic product compared with its population. and they will be key for hiring the more than 1 million additional STEM workers that will be needed in 2033 compared with 2023, according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. This increase marks a 10% growth rate, almost three times what is projected for any non-STEM industry during the same period. Immigrants are a big part of what has made America a global leader in science and technology. If Trump's nativist faction prevails and restricts the entry of skilled workers, that will have a profound effect on this leadership role, as well as on the U.S. economy. Closing borders is a mistake. The tech elite knows this. Musk, who was born in South Africa and now heads an advisory committee for the Trump administration called the Department of Government Efficiency, one he has since left, is one of many tech magnates who was born in South Africa and headed an advisory committee for the Trump administration called the Department of Government Efficiency, is one of many tech magnates who rely on the H-1B visa. Musk's Tesla company received approvals for 742 H-1B petitions for new hires during the 2024 federal fiscal year, more than double the number from a year earlier. Amazon, owned by Jeff Bezos, applied for nearly 3,900 H-1Bs in 2024. Most of the 25 companies that made the most H-1B requests in 2024 are technology firms, including Microsoft, Infosys, and Meta, the parent company of Facebook, run by Mark Zuckerberg. Despite the claims from Bannon and other hard-right MAGA supporters that H-1Bs rob American citizens of skilled jobs, the pipeline for domestic talent alone is unlikely to fill looming employment gaps. U.S. math scores have dropped, and the educational infrastructure at the most basic level is often just not there. Only half of U.S. high schools offer calculus, and 60% provide physics classes. Both skills are critical for designing quantum computers and achieving innovations in artificial intelligence. According to study estimates, just 3% or so of America's high school graduates join the ranks of STEM workers. Prominent legislation to promote STEM education has not met its funding targets. The Biden administration's CHIPS, C-H-I-P-S, and Science Act set out to invest billions of dollars in STEM education. But the funding appropriated for the National Science Foundation has been hundreds of millions less than what was originally requested. In addition to industry jobs, the basic and applied research that takes place at the nation's universities and tech hubs is highly reliant on overseas talent. An August 2020 report from the National Academy of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine, the NAS, notes that contributions from the large cadre of international students are critical to sustaining current levels of research in U.S. graduate programs. Foreign-born employees make up 43% of U.S. STEM workers who hold doctoral degrees, and this number rises to nearly 60% in computer science and certain other fields. These professionals bring abundant benefits to the STEM workforce. In 2022, more than half of U.S. startups with valuations greater than $1 billion had at least one immigrant at their helm, and the value of foreign-born professionals in this country can be witnessed on the global stage at the highest levels of human achievement. 40% of American Nobel Prize winners in chemistry, medicine, and physics in the past two decades have been immigrants. Uncertainties about immigration for tech jobs, reflected by the internal strife in the Trump team and among its supporters, could result in fractured policymaking, with foreign-born STEM workers getting placed under the same anti-immigrant policymaking umbrella as undocumented immigrants. In the fusillades of the MAGA Civil War, Trump took Musk's side, saying he has always been a big backer of H-1Bs, although the president has previously said the opposite. He once called the visas very, very bad for workers. In fact, during Trump's first term, his administration set up a partial H-1B blockade. The denial rate for the already short supply of the visas reached 24% in fiscal year 2018, It fell back to 2% in fiscal year 2022 after courts found his administration's handling of these visas to be unlawful. Cutting off the flow of foreign workers by rejecting H-1B applications can negatively affect and impact local economies and even hurt U.S. workers. In one 2014 study, researchers looking at this issue found that cities across the nation with high H-1B denial rates experienced a drop in computer-related jobs, and this decline was accompanied by lower wage growth for native-born citizens who lived there. The U.S. remains a prime destination for foreign-born students and professionals, but the status quo may not hold. Talent recruitment programs began to emerge in many countries in the 2010s. One prime example is Canada's Tech Talent Strategy, which afforded three-year work permits to as many as 10,000 people in the U.S. who have H-1B visas. The ultimate fix for the U.S.'s chronically broken immigration system would be to implement a long-sought massive overhaul through congressional legislation. Such comprehensive immigration reform would rationalize the competing demands of border security and the need to equitably regulate both legal and illegal immigration. But this kind of all-encompassing measure has little chance of being adopted during the next 4 years. In bringing wide attention to the role of legal immigration, the wrangling over H-1Bs may have an upside. On a podcast last year, the president remarked that international college students, once they graduate, should be eligible for green cards, which confer permanent residency. His administration could make good use on some variation of this idea. Other steps might raise the caps on H-1B visas granted annually, currently 85,000 in total, and institute much-needed reforms to the visa program, especially to ensure that visa holders are not exploited. Employers could do their part by seeking out underutilized programs, such as the O-1A temporary work visa for individuals with extraordinary ability. If nothing is done on H-1Bs and other legal immigration measures, the desirability of the U.S. as a destination for STEM students and tech workers will fade. The 2024 NSA report notes that between 2019 and 2023, the U.S. fell from first to eighth worldwide in scores for attractiveness to highly educated workers. It will probably slip further. The anti-immigrant atmosphere ushered in by the Trump administration's promised mass deportation of undocumented immigrants is also likely to sour foreign students and engineers on coming to the U.S., and this outcome will benefit no one. And this opinion and analysis from the Scientific American Board of Editors appears under Science Agenda in the March 2025 issue of Scientific American. From the May 2025 issue of Scientific American, in the department The Universe, written by Phil Plate, will an asteroid hit Earth? Astronomers pay close attention to potentially dangerous space rocks. You've no doubt seen this kind of news headline. Astronomers say space rock may hit Earth in the not-too-distant future! We usually get such warnings about one or two objects every year. The latest iteration concerns an asteroid, 2024 YR4, that is estimated to be more than 50 meters wide. For a while, there was a several percent chance of its impacting Earth, but after more observations, by the end of February 2025, an impact had essentially been ruled out. But how can anyone know such things? How do astronomers find these asteroids and then determine where they'll be many years into the future? We've actually known how to do this for centuries, thanks to German astronomer Johannes Kepler, who first figured out the requisite orbital laws in the 17th century. Since that time, the advent of better telescopes, digital cameras, and fast computers has made the task much easier, though by no means foolproof. There are around a dozen currently operating survey-type telescopic observatories that take wide-angle images of the sky every night and look for undiscovered objects zipping through our solar system. Seen from Earth, such objects appear to move relative to the far more distant fixed stars. Astronomers used to look for such motions by eye with photographs, but automation can now perform this task far faster and more accurately. Once a new moving object is found, its orbit needs to be determined. Is it on a circular path out past Mars, or does it have an elliptical orbit that brings it closer to Earth? This is where Kepler and his laws come in. He figured out that all orbits have one of three shapes: elliptical, parabolic, or hyperbolic. A circle is just an ellipse where the long and short axes are equal, so we lump circles in with ellipses. Parabolic and hyperbolic orbits are what we call open, meaning they don't close back on themselves. An object on an orbit like that is just passing through. It's moving rapidly enough to escape the sun's gravity and disappear into interstellar space. Most comets that fall in toward the sun from beyond Neptune, have nearly parabolic orbits. Only two objects have ever been found on extremely hyperbolic orbits: Oumuamua and the comet 2I Borisov. But an object in an elliptical orbit is bound to the sun and should orbit it indefinitely, unless it gets a gravitational kick from a planet, say. Our ability to predict a sun-orbiting object's future position comes from understanding everything we can about its ellipse. The basic characteristics of an orbital ellipse are its size, mathematically half the length of its long axis, a measurement called the semi-major axis, its eccentricity, which essentially measures how elliptical it is. Zero is circular and one is infinitely stretched out, like a line, and its orientation in space. An object's orbital ellipse can be tipped relative to that of Earth, for example, with its long axis pointed in some particular direction in space. Once we know all these parameters, called the orbital elements, we can mathematically define the associated ellipse. If we also know an asteroid's position along its ellipse, say on the date it was discovered or at a specific time during a subsequent observation, Kepler's equations tell us where along its orbit the asteroid should be on any given day. Well, in theory. In practice, it's not so easy. Forecasters usually need at least three well-separated observations of an asteroid to start nailing down all the variables governing the ellipse's shape. And those observations are not exact. Asteroids don't look like perfect tiny dots in an image, but instead are smeared out a bit, making it hard to know their precise position as they shift against the background stars. Such imprecisions may be small, but they add up. Thus, the result usually isn't an ideal ellipse, and the calculated path of the asteroid is fuzzy. In reality, its position might be a bit off from the predicted location. The further into the future, or past for that matter, you try to calculate the position, the worse the prediction gets. It's like the actual path of the asteroid is a cone with its vertex at the present position, opening up toward the direction in which you're trying to make predictions. Statistically speaking, the rock could be anywhere inside that cone, and that can add up to a large volume of space. The only way to narrow that path down is to get more observations, either fresh from telescopes or retroactively found in archival data. Also, the longer an object is observed, the more certain its orbital element measurements become. It's like being an outfielder in a baseball game. Imagine the pitcher throws the ball, but 1 second after the batter hits it, you have to close your eyes and guess where it will be so you can catch it. You can make a decent estimation, but it won't be anywhere near accurate enough to guide you. You must be able to keep your eye on the ball and watch as it moves to maximize your chances of making the catch. So we aim to observe asteroids for as long as possible to increase the temporal baseline of observations. There are obstacles, though. Some asteroids are small and decrease in brightness rapidly as the distance between them and Earth increases. This is the case for 2024 YR4, which is now moving away from Earth and forecasted to fade from view in late April, which means it would have happened a couple of months ago. Asteroids can also avoid observation by getting so close to the sun in the sky that they can't be seen for several months. Assuming, however, that an asteroid's orbit is well constrained and predictable, how do we know what the odds are of an Earth impact? Now we're getting to the important question. There are many methods for calculating this likelihood. One way is to simulate the orbit and note the dates when the object is in Earth's orbital vicinity, then determine whether our planet will be in its path at the same time. If so, well, that's bad, but not necessarily catastrophic. Earth is a small target, and the statistical volume of space the asteroid can be in on that date is usually large. Even for an apparently alarming asteroid, there's only a chance we'll get hit, and it's usually very low, especially the further in advance we try to predict it. There's only a chance we'll get hit, and it's usually very low. Typically, the odds of impact for any newfound potentially Earth-threatening space rock are one in thousands. In most cases, better observations nail down the path and show that it passes well away from Earth, and the odds drop effectively to zero. Irritatingly, the statistical chance of impact sometimes increases first, which is what happened with 2024 YR4. Remember, the asteroid is somewhere near the vertex of a large cone, and we don't know where. If Earth is near the cone's center line, then as the cone narrows with better observations, we're still inside it. The chance of impact goes up. But then, almost always, the cone narrows further and winds up pointing in a slightly different direction, leaving Earth safely outside it. And we can all breathe a sigh of relief. That's not to say we never get hit. Examples abound, such as the Chelyabinsk asteroid that exploded over Russia in 2013, the Tunguska event in Siberia in 1908, and the impact that formed Arizona's meteor crater 50,000 years ago. Every day, Earth plows through roughly 100 tons of interplanetary material, the vast majority of which is composed of tiny rocks that wind up as lovely meteors streaking across our sky. But sometimes those chunks of debris are bigger, much bigger. The bigger they get, the rarer they become, so truly devastating impacts are few and far between. They do happen, though, so we must keep our eyes on the sky. The good news is that even more telescopes are coming online, including the huge Vera C. Rubin Observatory in Chile and NASA's NEO Surveyor, planned for launch in 2027. And they should help us not just map where these objects are and where they're headed, but also determine their size and what they're made of. If some asteroid big enough to do damage has us in its crosshairs, we hope we'll know about it as soon as we can, giving us enough time, perhaps, to do something about it. The more telescopes we have covering the greater amount of sky over time, the better. And this reassuring article about whether or not an asteroid will hit Earth was written by Phil Plate. And in this same issue of Scientific American, Mark Fischetti gives us another glimpse of history 50, 100, and 150 years ago. First, from 1975, introducing the video disc. A video disc system that presents recorded pictures and sound on a television set will be put on the market next year by North American Philips Corporation and MCA Inc. The player looks somewhat like a phonograph, and the record resembles a phonograph record. The distinctive feature is an optical stylus, which replaces the needle of the phonograph. The stylus is a scanner employing a 1 milliwatt helium neon laser as its sensor. The record is not touched by the playing device and therefore will not wear out or deteriorate. The optical stylus also makes it possible to pick out randomly part of a record for display, to run a scene in reverse or in slow motion, and to view a film frame by frame. The companies plan to sell the player for about $500, and the records for $2 to $10, depending on their length and content, which could include motion picture films, instructional films, sports events, and news reels. Also from 1975, A Giant Eye for Extraterrestrials. Cyclops, an array of 1,500 radio antennas, each 100 meters in diameter, has been proposed by a NASA-sponsored study as a tool for detecting signals from extraterrestrial civilizations. The antennas would be connected to one another and to a large computer system. The effective signal collecting area would be hundreds of times greater than that of any existing radio telescope, and would be capable of detecting even such weak signals as the internal radio frequency communications of a civilization as far away as several hundred light years. A note, the proposed Project Cyclops was shelved because of high anticipated costs. 100 years ago in 1925, first, colored lights reveal speeding. An idea has been suggested for a signal plate firmly attached to a car bearing three or four differently colored lights. These would be attached to the speedometer so that the white light, for example, would burn when the speed was 10 to 15 miles an hour, the blue light between 15 and 30 miles per hour, the red at 40 miles per hour, and so on. If any officer or citizen saw a car running on a street and burning a red light, that would be sufficient evidence that the speed limit was being exceeded to a dangerous extent. Something has to be done to make our streets safer. Island universes. Thousands of universes, each similar to the galaxy of stars of which our sun is an insignificant member, with the nearest universe so distant that its light travels for a million years before it reaches us, have been shown to exist by Edwin P. Hubble of the Mount Wilson Observatory. Through telescopes, these universes appear to be clouds of light, more or less with a spiral structure. By means of variable stars in these galaxies, the distance of a few has been determined, and in the opinion of Harlow Shapley, director of the Harvard College Observatory, this proves the theory that they are island universes lying entirely outside our own system. Edwin P. Hubble would undoubtedly be very pleased to know that the space telescope named after him has just observed its 35th year birthday. The longevity of the Hubble Space Telescope is thanks in large part to a series of five missions to repair and update components from 1993 to 2009, and it is still revolutionizing astronomy. Also from 1925, old-time graffiti. Human nature is a pretty constant thing. Archaeologists digging in the ruins at Saqqara have found columns which were once part of an ancient Egyptian temple. Over 3,000 years ago, it was already a showplace, a sort of Washington Monument of the time. On the columns are scribbled names and comments, written there by visitors of 30 centuries ago, just as people write their names and addresses on the walls of public buildings today. And from 150 years ago in 1875, balloon deaths. Croce Spinelli and Seville, two French aeronauts, have laid down their lives in the cause of science. With M. Gaston Tissandier, they attempted to ascend to a higher altitude than had ever been reached, to make experiments for carbonic acid, conduct spectroscopic observations, and in general obtain data. It was believed possible by inhaling oxygen from a respirator. At 29,000 feet elevation, all three men became unconscious. The balloon soared higher and higher and then descended. Tissandier regained his senses on reaching respirable air, to find his companions dead from suffocation. And this peek at history 50, 100, and 150 years ago appears in the May 2025 issue of Scientific American. And now a New York Times trilobite. Clever cockatoos have figured out how to drink from water fountains. They had also learned how to flip open garbage lids in the suburbs of Sydney, Australia. Scientists wonder what they'll work out next. Most birds go for ease when looking for drinking water. But the sulfur-crested cockatoos in the suburbs of Sydney, Australia, often prefer to quench their thirst with a challenging puzzle. In the city's western suburbs, some of the birds have figured out how to use public drinking fountains. The mohawked parrots deftly use one foot to twist the handle open, while their other claw grips the spout. It's unclear why the cockatoos go to the effort of using drinking fountains when there are plenty of accessible water sources nearby. They don't seem to use them more often during hot weather. One possible explanation is that the task of operating the fountains is simply more fun than sipping water from the local creeks. If there is no super urgent need and you're not dying of thirst, then why not do something you enjoy? Said Barbara C. Klump, an author of A Study of the Birds, published a few weeks ago in the journal Biology Letters, and a behavioral ecologist at the Max Planck Institute of Animal Behavior in Germany. It's not the first time cockatoos in this area of Australia have been cleverly manipulating urban objects for their own benefit. Dr. Klump and her colleagues have also tracked the birds flipping open garbage bins across Greater Sydney, a socially learned behavior that has resulted in an arms race, or maybe a wing race, with human residents. And a New York Times trilobite about this was on a program earlier this spring. These birds do seem to be thriving in city settings, said Kevin McGraw, a behavioral ecologist at Michigan State University, who was not involved in the paper. He said that could be explained by their ability to adapt to their urban and suburban environments. Dr. Klump first spotted cockatoos drinking from public bubblers during field research for another project in 2018. At first, she thought someone had forgotten to turn the tap off, but video footage revealed one bird grabbing the spring-loaded handle with its foot to activate the trickling water. Local wildlife officials told Dr. Klump that the cockatoos in the area had been doing so for years. Then, of course, a million questions went through my mind, Dr. Klump said. One of them was, how the hell did they figure that out? To find out, Dr. Klump and her colleagues tagged 24 birds from a population of as many as 150 living in a reserve in western Sydney. They installed cameras in front of drinking fountains to catch the birds in action. The cockatoos attempted to use the drinking fountains more than 500 times during 44 days of footage. Some 70% of the tagged birds tried using the bubblers, a hint they had probably been engaging in the behavior for some time. But less than half of the cockatoos were successful, suggesting the activity requires a complex sequence of motor skills that are tricky to master. Similar to the way humans pick up new skills, the cockatoos probably developed their fountain hacking talents through a mix of watching one another and individual experimentation, Dr. Klump said. While male cockatoos were better at flipping open heavy garbage bin lids than females in earlier studies, both sexes were equally adept at operating the drinking fountains. The cockatoos used the drinking fountains at similar times each day, regardless of the weather. This suggests the birds are using them as a regular water source rather than just a backup when conditions are tough. And although the behavior hasn't spread across multiple suburbs like the bin opening trend has, Lucy Applin, a behavioral ecologist at Australian National University and a co-author of the study, said residents in Brisbane have spotted cockatoos using drinking fountains there, too. Because the birds don't migrate, the Brisbane birds couldn't have learned from the Sydney flock. That suggests there's potential for the independent invention of the behavior and local spread in other places, Dr. Applin said. Andrea Griffin, a behavioral ecologist at the University of Newcastle in Australia, who wasn't involved in the study, said she was not surprised that cockatoos have learned to operate drinking fountains. Their motor skills, attraction to novelty, and ability to watch and learn from one another make them natural innovators. There are a lot of parameters that would favor innovation in a species like this, Dr. Griffin said. Dr. Klump and her colleagues are taking a closer look at the behavior, such as how long it takes the cockatoos to master the skill. The researchers are also curious to know what the cockatoos will do next. Dr. Klump said, "I'd love to learn more about what else they have up their sleeves, so to speak." And clever cockatoos have figured out how to drink from water fountains is a New York Times trilobite that was posted on June 3, 2025, and written by Gemma Conroy. And that brings us to the end of today's broadcast of Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I've been your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And remember, if you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org and click Broadcast Info and Audio. Thank you so much for listening, and please join me again next week.